This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It is the very nature of a bubble that to exist, it needs to be filled with air. When the financial bubble burst last September, it felt as though the government, the financial community, economists, you and me, all of us, were struck unawares. In retrospect, the road to meltdown was littered with red flags. Many of the factors that contributed to the collapse had been inflating for years. Many blame lax regulation by the government, but what about that other watchdog, the free press? In retrospect, did the business press provide the information we needed? And if not, why not? Later in the hour, Craigslist pulls its erotic services ads after the case of the Craigslist killer. Craigslist CEO Jim Buckmaster joins us to argue the site does not promote either violence or prostitution. But first, when it comes to the meltdown, did you get the news you needed? Who or what news source do you trust now? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. We begin with David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal and a regular contributor to Morning Edition. And David, it's very good of you to be with us today.
It's a pleasure, Neil.
And the Wall Street Journal is, the very model of the serious financial press here in the United States. So with the benefit of hindsight, did you get it right?
We got some of it right, but we didn't get enough of it right. You look back at the coverage we did in the early 2000s, and you can see stories warning about subprime loans, about credit default swaps, about the housing bubble. But did we understand the enormity of what was going on, the risks that Merrill Lynch and AIG and Lehman were taking? No, we weren't. We didn't get it, just like their CEOs and regulators didn't get it. So I would say we did a good job, but not a good enough job.
And interestingly, you say you go back to the early 2000s. There is a theory that that was some good reporting then, but less well. The dots were less well connected later on.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that. It's easy after the fact to say, oh, this is the stories we should have done in 2006 and 2007. That's always the case. It's like if you knew you were going to have a car accident at the corner of Connecticut and K in Washington, you probably wouldn't steer your car into the intersection of Connecticut and K. So I don't think it's right to say, with the benefit of hindsight, why didn't you do story X or story Y? What you can do is go back and look at the stories we did and say, did we identify some of the things that were going on that, as you say, were warning flags? And I think the answer is yes. Did we understand the enormity of it? No, of course not. And did we, maybe it was a failure of imagination as much as a failure of diligence on the part of the reporters.
Was there a failure to speak truth to power? The business press, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, other media are covering, they're all covering the same people. They all live in the same world.
I think that's a problem that we're always aware of. It's not so much a question of advertising. In some ways, it's much easier for the Wall Street Journal to speak truth to Merrill Lynch than it is for a small-town newspaper to speak truth to the local car dealer or local department store, which is responsible for so much of their business. But one always has to guard against being so close to your sources that you begin to see the world the same way. And in many cases, a lot of the people who were doing this didn't know what they were doing, and a good reporter was one who could understand what they were doing and then stand outside it. We did some of that. We didn't do enough of it.
Were you covering news for investors or were you covering news for citizens?
Well, I think our job is to do both. You know, the Wall Street Journal is a big paper, and it's become even more general interest in the last year or so since Rupert Murdoch bought it. We do have a responsibility to investors. We have a money and investing section. We talk about individual stocks and stuff like that. But we consider ourselves part of the press, what Thomas Jefferson talked about, that check on power. And so we wrote about the risk that Fannie Mae presented to and Freddie Mac presented to the government. We wrote about subprime loans, even though very few people who get subprime loans are likely to be subscribers to the Wall Street Journal.
And if warning flags were raised, were they ignored? And if so, why?
I think that's a good question. I mean, I think we probably didn't shout loudly enough. If we had it to do all over again, we would have written more stories. We would have been more strident. We would have looked for more examples to show how this was really working. We would have tried harder to understand the complexities of the system and not just the stuff on the surface. But there is a limit to how much the press can do if people don't want to listen. And that one of the definitions of a bubble is a kind of suspension of skepticism. And there's no doubt that that was happening. I mean, think about what was going on. People were buying houses that they knew they couldn't afford, and other people were lending them money, and then someone else was buying that mortgage, even though everybody knew that the person hadn't put their income on the statement when they applied for the mortgage. So there was a general suspension of disbelief. And so if you warned, you were seen as some Chicken Little person, and for a couple of years, it looked like the optimists were right, and then it all came crashing down.
Yet it turned out there was even more going on than that. There were these boiler rooms operating where not only were people being peddled mortgages they couldn't be paid back, there were forgeries going on, and contracts were being changed on the fly and in the middle of the night.
Yeah, but I don't think that's the most amazing part of this. Yes, that was going on, and we should have added more of those people, and more of those people should go to jail, and I'm sure they will. But what's more disturbing and more serious, I think, is the whole system seemed to have lost its moorings, that inside Merrill Lynch, inside Bear Stearns, inside AIG, those weren't boiler rooms. Those were the most sophisticated, smartest people that Wall Street had, and they were building a house of cards that came falling down, and they didn't realize the risk they were taking, or they didn't seem to protect themselves against the risk they were taking, and neither did their regulators.
At the same time that element of corruption was going on, there was, as you say, this sophisticated operation, investment things that I didn't understand, and did you?
No, I didn't. I mean, I'm not sophisticated enough to understand all the workings of a CDO and CLO swap and CDO cubed and all that, the stuff that people were doing. And I dare say that some of the CEOs of the big banks didn't understand it either. It's very hard, though, for a massive fraud. I mean, look at the Bernie Madoff thing, to bring down the whole system. So it had to have been more than just a handful of rotten apples. It looks like the whole barrel was rotten. There was no foundation to some of this trading, and it was all built on the expectation that house prices would go up forever, we'd never have an economic rain, and it was wrong.
We're talking with David Wessel, economics editor of The Wall Street Journal, about, did the business press, in this case in particular The Wall Street Journal, miss the story of the financial meltdown? Did it miss the red flags that were there in the pathway to the bubble bursting? I've mixed about 18 metaphors there, and I'll no doubt hear about that by email. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's see if we can get some callers on the line. We'll begin with Ray, and Ray's with us from Boca Raton in Florida.
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. I would just like to say that I tend to trust the commentators that I see on the media who go against the grain, such as Joe Battipaglia that I saw on the stock report of CNBC, who seems to be, for the most part, saying that things like the current rally is nothing more than a relief rally, and that, problems are probably quite a bit worse than they seem to be being portrayed.
So you're listening to advice that suggests that what we're in now is another mini-bubble.
A relief rally.
A relief rally. Okay.
In the midst of an L.
So instinctively now, did you always go for the countervailing opinion?
Pretty much. I've had an account that I traded almost like a day trader, and I always considered that to be play money. My real money for my retirement and so forth, thank God, I put into treasury issues, CDs and banks that are guaranteed by the government, and it's held me in good stead.
All right, Ray, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
I think the problem is it's easy to be contrarian. It's easy to go on TV or the radio or write in a column saying that everybody else is wrong, and if they're optimistic, it's time to be pessimistic and vice versa. I think it's very hard as a reader or a listener to know when do you believe the counter-conventional wisdom and when is it right. Alan Greenspan warned about irrational exuberance in 2006. It turns out he was right, but if you'd sold all your stocks then, you would have lost a lot of money. You would have foregone a lot of profits because the stock market went up 80% before it started coming down.
Here's an email from Amy in Shingle House, Pennsylvania. According to some journalists, they were writing about how crazy the derivative market was and the looming bursting of the housing bubble. However, I have to say the media seriously dropped the ball. Editors told the reporters they couldn't say bad things about the market. Therefore, I, for one, don't really believe anything anyone has to say anymore. It's all spin, and I am too dizzy.
Well, I worry a lot about people like that because I think the credibility of the press, the polls show, has fallen in recent years. But I can just assure no one ever said to any reporter at the Wall Street Journal that I know of, you can't say anything that upset the market. It's hard to figure out sometimes what's going on. And in sometimes when you try and get it balanced, you end up underplaying some of the risks. And I think we're conscious of that. But I worry quite a bit about the fact that people think, especially think that business reporters and people who write about the stock market are more spin and entertainment than serious journalists. It's not the case of the Wall Street Journal. I can't speak for other places.
And we just have a minute or so left, but I wanted to ask you, lessons learned. What are you doing differently?
Well, I think one thing we need is we need more sophisticated reporters. This was some of the most complicated stuff going on Wall Street. We need to do a better job of that. Secondly, we need to be more careful to think about what the Cassandras are saying, and even if we disagree with them, to spend more time thinking about that economist at the University of Chicago who says this isn't making sense and stuff, so that we can, because it's easy to get for those people to get drowned out. They're sometimes right, they're sometimes wrong, but we will listen more carefully in the future.
And are you listening to Cassandras now?
Yeah, but it's easy now after the bubbles burst to say the world is falling. I think the trick now is to make sure you don't blind yourself to the optimism. I mean, what if the recession's over and the economy's coming back and we're trying to undo the fight the last war and be too pessimistic? So it's always a challenge to know who's right and who's not when you're basically predicting the future.
David Wessel, we thank you for your time today. Appreciate it.
A pleasure.
David Wessel is the economics editor of the Wall Street Journal, a regular contributor to NPR's Morning Edition. You hear him every morning, or, well, not almost every morning. Anyway, seems like every morning lately. And he joined us here in Studio 3A. We thank him very much for his time. When it comes to the financial meltdown, did you get the news you needed? Who or what news sources do you trust now? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. In just a moment, we'll be talking with Dean Starkman, who conducted an extensive survey of articles that, well, everybody in the business media wrote over the past 9 years or so. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our main focus today, did the business press miss the financial meltdown? Dean Starkman argues in the Columbia Journalism Review, yes, this is the watchdog that did not bark, he wrote. We've posted a link to his critique of the media at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. We're also taking your calls. Leading up to the financial crisis, did you get the news you needed? Who or what news source do you trust now? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Dean Starkman, the assistant managing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review and the editor of its business press section, conducted an extensive review of articles in the major business publications over the past 8 or 9 years, and he joins us now from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to be with you, Neil.
And I guess the title of your piece in the May-June edition of the CJR seems to summarize your conclusion, blindness.
That's about the size of it. The question you asked I thought was good. Did you get the news you needed over that period when the bubble was forming? And my conclusion after a lot of reading was no. We were looking for what the news you needed was, as David Wessel just said, the fact that the financial system had become unmoored, unhinged, and you had abusive lenders. Funded by Wall Street bankers, and unfortunately, readers didn't know about that.
Is he right that some red flags were raised?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, it's a long piece. It's 6,400 words, so there's some nuance to this argument. I don't want to paint with too broad a brush. He's right in the sense that there was some discussion. I thought the business press was pretty good, particularly on calling the bubble, talking about rising housing prices and how those couldn't be sustained. Also that they were very good on pointing out how there were a lot of defective mortgage products on the market and you shouldn't take one out. My problem with those, I call those necessary and useful, but not sufficient. Those are geared basically to investors or consumers, but they really don't speak to the systemic problems. The fact that institutions were running amok and they weren't on top of that.
And I wonder if you look at the argument that this was just. Where was the blindness? Was it in the editorial offices? Was it with the reporters? Was it with the ownership? Where did it fall?
I think this is really a question of editorial leadership and news ownership. We're talking about. I think there's plenty of capacity and will and ability to take on the Countrywides and the New Centuries and the AmeriQuests and the IndyMax and Merrill Lynch, et cetera, that all that stuff that wasn't done. I think that the resources of the business press need to be trained to be turned and deployed properly, and that's been the problem. I think it really has been a leadership problem.
And you were careful not to say, look, this is not an award for who did least badly or best worst or anything like that. But were any single reporters or any individual publications better than others?
Yeah, that's the question all the business reporters
and editors
I bet ask.
They do.
Sure. There was some wonderful stuff, and that was sort of part of the pleasure of going back over the record. So actually, one of the highlights of the entire period, which I studied, 2000 to mid-2007, was a story published in the March of 2000 by Diana Henriquez with Lowell Bergman in the New York Times, and it was about Lehman Brothers funding a notorious predatory lender called First Alliance Mortgage. And if you sort of scroll through some of the highlights, you'll see some great stuff by Peter Coy, who you guys mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. of Business Week. Really, I thought the highlight of the period was done by actually the LA Times, which in 2005 really went after in a serious and sustained way AmeriQuest, which was then the nation's leading subprime lender. And a very powerful institution with a very highly politically connected owner, Roland Arnall, who was subsequently named ambassador to the Netherlands by President Bush. They took AmeriQuest on frontally in a very direct way and essentially called them a boiler room operation. And in fact, that's exactly what they were.
And the sad news, of course, is that the business section of the Los Angeles Times is a mere shell of what it was.
Yeah, it's a terrible tragedy, and it's happening, of course, at the business sections around the country. What's interesting is that I found some of the best work the best stuff I found over that period was done, in fact, by business sections of the big metro dailies, particularly the LA Times and the New York Times, and with some wonderful work done by the Washington Post. And by the way, you know, a lot of other smaller papers.
Sure.
But the reason I mention that is that I think there's an advantage to being one step away from the business world. If you're all business news all the time, I think you're sort of inside of a framework that makes it difficult to take on some of the more powerful institutions. I think the great metro dailies sort of had a half a step outside of that world and better, probably more connected to their communities, frankly. And that's where some of the best work was done. And yeah, it's horrible, the fact that these things are a shadow of what they used to be.
And we'll get some calls on in just a moment, but we also have to acknowledge that you used to work for the Wall Street Journal, covering real estate. And did you contribute to this? Is this the pot calling the kettle black?
Yeah, I mean, I was working at the Journal from 96 to 2000, end of 2004, and during the relevant period, I was covering commercial real estate. And no, I did nothing of particular significance that would have given anybody a decent warning. We were, you know, I was covering shopping malls and office buildings, and to some degree, the world of commercial mortgage-backed securities. We talked about rising prices for assets, and particularly real estate assets, but. You know, on the other hand, this is not a commercial real estate problem. So I guess that's my defense.
Okay. We're talking with Dean Starkman, who's the assistant managing editor now of the Columbia Journalism Review and editor of The Audit at CJR blog. And 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And Cynthia joins us from San Antonio.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I've kind of gotten my information from three sources. Observing, and I could see driving through Texas and especially Dallas, I could see the mounds and mounds of housing being built, and I thought, oh my gosh, are they overbuilding, which I guess they were. The second thing is I have a relative in the mortgage business, and he kept telling me, you can't believe what's going on in this business. And he was telling me this for years. He said, you can't believe it. The third thing, I read solely the Financial Times for my financial information. And from those three things, especially from the Times, I had a sense of impending disaster and have had for 10 years. I got out of all real estate holdings. I basically got in a very conservative blanket over the head mode. And so I felt like that from those three things, I was aware of what was getting ready to happen.
A peach-colored blanket, no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, honey.
Dean Starkman, did the FT do better than other media?
It did better and worse, depending on what you're looking at. They had people actually looking at derivatives as a beat. Gillian Tett, among them, you've probably heard of, and other folks, and John Plender is another. And so they were sort of pounding away at this idea that, hey, there are these things called collateralized debt obligations, and they're really murky, and there's a lot more of them than there used to be, and same with credit default swaps and the like. Everything is sort of in hindsight, and I can, you know, sort of pick apart anybody's work. So, no, that was great stuff. And I think, you know, if we're giving away prizes, which we're not, basically, by the way, they would win the prize for derivatives coverage. In no way did they link it to the abusive lending that was going on, the raw material for this stuff. And I don't think the word predatory lending or subprime loans really entered their vocabulary until 2007.
And clearly, Cynthia, your friend in the mortgage business deserves a prize, too.
Oh, absolutely. We knew what was getting ready to come. We knew what was going on. And what I couldn't believe is that there was no either federal agency or anything overlooking this everybody seemed to be clueless as to what was going on. But it was well known in the mortgage industry. It was well known.
Cynthia, thanks very much for the call.
You bet.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from Alejo. I trust the Wall Street Journal. I read it daily for most of 2007 and 2008, and I think they provided an elegant blend of 80% information and 20% interpretation. The Free Press should not be held responsible for not telling us what to do, but for telling us the truth. I think the Wall Street Journal did that. Is that a fair evaluation?
There's a lot of truth to that, that's for sure. I mean, the journal coverage, certainly post-crash, which you can sort of date to the beginning, to the middle of 2007, has contained a lot of very elegant writing and very deep reporting and some wonderfully probing stuff about how CDOs came to be. And they did a wonderful piece about Merrill Lynch. They did excellent work on bad regulation. My beef with them, and I, you know, again, it's with the institution of the business press writ large, was really taking on powerful institutions at the time they were doing all the bad stuff, and while they were still powerful, and that's where there's this to me, that's where the blind spot is, and it's not a spot. It's a hole you could drive a truck through.
Let's get Rachel on the line. Rachel, with us from Cleveland.
Yes, I do listen to NPR, and I love NPR, but I do feel like the media did not do us justice in the subprime crisis. And I'm still surprised. I did my own research to try to figure out what happened, and I'm surprised that no media service that I've found so far has reported on the last administration's policies that were pushing the housing bubble. The America's Home Ownership Challenge that the Bush administration put together, where he met with the 24 largest banks and asked them to loosen credit standards. He challenged the banking industry to get 5.5 million subprime minority loans, and he asked them to come up with creative loan packages to do it. So you're putting the riskiest people in the riskiest loan products. And nobody's really reported on that yet. And on top of that, they did the America's Dream Down Payment Act to give down payments to people that couldn't afford it during the last administration, as well as ask Fannie and Freddie to catch up with the private sector and to offer zero down, interest only, and adjustable mortgages. And none of that's really been discussed yet.
Well, to be fair, I think, Rachel, it's not just the Bush administration, but the Clinton administration before it that pressed for the dream of American home ownership and in the process of relaxing standards of lending. And
it's actually, under Bush, it was the largest, he had the largest push and on top of made the largest homeowners during that time period, minority and subprime, under his huge plan. And if you go onto the White House press documents, you can find all the documents and how.
Well, we're trying to focus today on the media's responsibility. we're sort of acknowledging that the federal government had some problems here. But Dean Starkman, she also raised some questions about NPR. And for different reasons, you decided not to analyze broadcasters for the most part.
Yeah, there were practical reasons. It was hard to do, but and also substantive reasons. When we excluded broadcast, I was sort of more self-consciously excluding CNBC, which is sort of the 800-pound gorilla of broadcast financial news. And I just my feeling was, and I don't think there's any reason to think that I was wrong, is that they're really not in the warning business. Mm-hmm. They don't do predatory lending investigations, and nor did they trace the. Are they in the business of tracking down exactly how Wall Street's making its money, and with particularly via the underwriting of subprime lenders.
We're talking with Dean Starkman of the Columbia Journalism Review. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email from Kristen in Dublin, Ohio. When things are good, do we want to hear from the naysayers? Do you think that's an interesting question? The psychological issue of, you know,
that one's for me.
I think it is for you. But,
sure. I know I've heard this quite a bit, and I know that there's it's a big sentiment among my friends in the business press that, you know, it's difficult to cut through the euphoria and that people aren't ready to hear your Cassandra-like warnings and whatnot. My experience, though, is that that's not the case. If you're executing great investigations of institutions gone wrong, and whether it's a big lender or the big Wall Street underwriter, the public is always happy to latch onto those stories, and they read them eagerly. It's not really a question about don't bother us; we're too busy taking out a home equity loan.
And the same question I put to David Wessel at the end of our conversation with him: lessons learned. I mean, you pointed we've mentioned one change already, and that's the decimation of a lot of business sections in newspapers around the country. That's changed things already. But nevertheless, do you think lessons have been absorbed, and what lessons should we take from these mistakes?
Yeah, I would recommend the exact opposite lessons that David would take away. Yeah, I mean, of course, you would like a few more sophisticated reporters, and you do want to listen to the Cassandras. But actually, you know, I would hire a few less sophisticated reporters and people who are able to sort of step back from the noise and the. The sort of bubble that forms around the business press and its sources. I mean, what you really need in the business press is a truly beefed up investigative capacity, and not only that, but not just a wing of the newsroom, but it has to the investigative culture has to be returned to the front and center of to the heart of news organizations, all the way up through the hierarchy, and that's job one.
And do you think in the present climate, given the character and the financial structures of most media organizations these days, that's likely to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I understand, you know, and I'm not trying to necessarily kick the news media while it's down, and I know it is down. But what we're looking for right now is, or what we're thinking about right now is two things. One is we're trying to figure out ways to deploy the resources that we have, we meaning the public, and the resources meaning the several thousand business news editors and reporters who are working today. And so this is really, so what do we do with the actually very formidable resources we have right now? And that's sort of what we have to think about. Also, I understand that we're sort of in the middle of a sort of a collapsing media economy, and I understand that we are going to need to rebuild news organizations under new models. But while we do that, we also have to keep in mind sort of what's the point, what are we doing this for, and what these news organizations are going to be doing once they're built.
Dean Starkman, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
You're awfully welcome.
Dean Starkman, Assistant Managing Editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, editor of its Business Press section, with us today from our bureau in New York. Coming up after the case of the so-called Craigslist killer, the website's CEO joins us to defend it against accusations that Craigslist is inherently unsafe and that it promotes prostitution. Jim Buckmaster will be with us next to take your calls. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.